Thank you, Ricky, and for epic timekeeping. The first of the two following presentations is going to be given by Sean Donovan, who is Commissioner for the New York City Department of Housing Preservation.
Thank you. I want to start, if I could have the first slide, please. At the risk of wading into a debate that's actually clearly been an intense one thus far, could I have the first slide, please? I just want to try and go back over a little bit of the context that has obviously been intensely discussed so far. Had I known that Jane Jacobs might have been such a intense symbol of that debate, I might have chosen a different first heading there. But I don't want to try and revisit the discussion that that you've all had, but more to really tell this story from a perspective of a city, specifically a city agency, with the task of trying in a city like New York to create a level of affordable housing, which is, to say the least, challenging. And so you've heard the story of the 1970s abandonment, symbolized most clearly by the South Bronx. And from the city's perspective, I think Ron Schiffman and others have talked about the crucial role that community groups played in the transformation of those neighborhoods. But I would also venture to say that the city had an equally crucial role in doing that. And it was really, in many ways, the housing investment that helped drive the neighborhood revitalization along with the participation of those local community groups. And to sort of graphically illustrate this, if you think about the neighborhoods in the South Bronx, some of them lost 75% of their population during that decade. Literally, owners of the traditional old law and new law tenements in those areas, and even denser buildings, 6-7 stories, were literally paying people to come in and strip out the plumbing and then burn the buildings down to collect the insurance proceeds. And my agency at that point, not that I was there, but the agency at that point, began in a move some thought was bold, others insane, literally started taking over ownership of these buildings from their owners. In tax foreclosure. And at the height in the late 70s of that effort, my agency had control of over 100,000 apartments throughout the city. 100,000 apartments that were really, quite frankly, in the most desperate condition of any housing in the city. Today, my agency holds about 3,000 of those apartments. The 100,000 plus that we no longer control have been through the capital that the city has invested in them, the efforts of local community groups who are now the owners of them, led what is an enormous revitalization that you've heard about in those neighborhoods. And really, I think it was part of the leading edge, and we have plenty of evidence. NYU and others have done, I think, very good work, studies showing the impact that housing investment had. We now come to the decade of the 90s, where the city added close to 700,000 people, more than the entire city of Washington, D.C., the entire city of Boston, Denver, Seattle. You can take many significant American cities. We added more people during the last decade than any of those cities have in their entire limits today. And so what we are faced with as an agency, as a city trying to create affordable housing, is very much a different problem. I like to say that we're victims of our own success in that sense, that we now face in these very same neighborhoods a intense shortage of affordable housing, of housing overall. New York City has a vacancy rate of 3% overall in its housing market, when a healthy market has a minimum vacancy of 5%, and many cities around the country are now facing vacancy rates of 10 or higher percent. For affordable housing, by most definitions, the vacancy rate is closer to 2%. So a desperate struggle in many parts of the city now, given this added population and the rising prices, to try and create affordable housing. Just to give you a sense of those rising prices, we did a recent study of land prices across the city that showed that on average for the last 5 years, vacant land has gone up by 60% per year. So imagine now, as an agency, trying in that framework to continue to create affordable housing when, in fact, the most obvious resource we had was those 100,000 units that we owned and could control and actually determine their outcome. Clearly, and you've talked in depth about the risks of the current situation we're facing. Not only do we have an economy that is increasingly producing sort of jobs at the top and the bottom of the income spectrum, but also this push has actually obviously raised the specter that many of the neighborhoods that even today are integrated both on a racial and an income basis will not be 10 years from now if we continue along this path. There are two fundamental pieces to the equation here in terms of resources that we have been able to play with. One, obviously, I talked about the property and the land that the city controlled, which we no longer do. And so a fundamental challenge is, where is that land going to come from? But in addition, the funding levels. And we have an enormous threat right now in Washington to the federal commitment to housing policy, programs that are proposed to be eliminated and others next year in the president's budget. But at the same time, an increasing commitment at the city level. When Mayor Bloomberg came in to office, he actually added $1 billion over 5 years to the city's housing commitment. So we do have those resources, but increasingly the challenge of where to build, where to find the land resources for affordable housing is central to our challenge. And so what I want to talk about is sort of the broader spectrum of work that we're doing to try and ensure that there is available land for affordable housing, and in particular to talk about the zoning tools and the way that we're trying to use them to ensure integrated neighborhoods as we go forward. Next, please. Amanda Burden is here, and I won't sort of talk too much about what a dramatic job she's done in helping to rethink what has really been an industrial era zoning policy in the city and try to bring it forward into our times, but also focus on much of the abandoned waterfront and industrial areas. We've lost 1 million industrial jobs in the city from its height that I don't think anyone believes will come back. And there's an enormous opportunity in rethinking the use of that land as we go forward. And these are just a number of examples of the many, many rezonings that are going on across the city, which have the potential to create over 100,000 units of housing as part of that. And let me be clear, there is an enormous need to create new housing, period, at all income levels in order to stem the pressure and the housing crisis that we have in New York. Next. So let me come then to Greenpoint Williamsburg. And again, Amanda can do a much better job than I can talking about the details of the rezoning itself. I want to focus on the affordable housing aspect of it, but let me just go through it quickly. It is an enormous rezoning, 180 blocks that includes not just the waterfront area, about 2 miles of waterfront, but also a significant upland area as well, away from the water. Much of that has been zoned industrial for many, many decades. And the re-envisioning of this area will include primarily residential development. Over 10,000 units of housing is the potential that we see, development that we see over the next 10 years, as well as what is now really a completely abandoned waterfront. The last plant here was the Domino Sugar Factory, at one point the largest sugar factory in the world, that just closed down last year. It was the last active real large-scale manufacturing on that waterfront. But to bring access to that waterfront from throughout the community, as well as create a new 27-acre park in the middle of that waterfront. At the same time, in the upland areas, trying to balance a preservation of what industrial activity is left there and to enhance it, while, as I said, looking for opportunities to rezone for residential use. Next. In terms of affordable housing, there was a bedrock principle that we had to try and attempt to make sure that there was a significant percentage of affordable housing in this rezoning. And it really involved a combination of three resources. I talked about the financial resources that the city has committed earlier. Second of all, and I think this is the area where I want to spend the most time, is what we call inclusionary zoning. And fundamentally, we have an equation in this city and in many others where the real estate market is, and the increases in prices that we're seeing, is driving out the possibility for creating affordable housing. What we were attempting to do with inclusionary zoning is essentially turn that equation on its head, to harness the value and the increasing value of the real estate that we're looking at, and the new value that's created by the change of use to residential and the significant upzoning that's taking place, to harness that value and dedicate at least a portion of that towards affordable housing. Now, how do we do that? A fairly simple mechanism, which is to say to developers that they can build at a certain density without including affordable housing, but if they include affordable housing within those developments, that they will be able to build more density. And so essentially, the economics of that extra density they're able to build incentivizes the creation of affordable housing as part of those new neighborhoods and those new developments. The third resource that we have available here is public sites. And quite simply, it's a commitment that rather than auctioning those sites for what economists might call highest and best use, that we will use those resources to create affordable housing where the city controls the land. Now, there are many sort of complexities of doing this in a market where we're not simply looking at development that takes place today or next year, but over a long period of time. And so there are a number of things that we've tried to take into account, both the different types of development to ensure that whether it's rental or ownership, tenure issues, that we can ensure that affordable housing is created. Also recognizing that these are neighborhoods where in the traditional way that affordable housing is created, whether it's 10 years from now or 20 years from now and the agreements with those private developers expire, that there will be enormous difficulty and displacement for those residents if those properties aren't kept affordable. And so we've specifically said to the developers that any density that they get in relation to this policy, they must in return keep this affordable housing permanent, that there will be no displacement or no increasing rents up to market rate at some later point in the spectrum or in the cycle of real estate. And then finally, to try and not just look at creating new affordable housing, but try to harness these incentives so that developers have an incentive to fight against what might otherwise be gentrification and displacement in the neighborhoods. And we do that by simply saying to developers that they have the option to purchase existing buildings within the neighborhoods and to renovate those and keep them permanently affordable, thereby not just protecting affordable housing, but also protecting the residents that are there and that would be at risk of displacement given the neighborhood change that's going on. Next. Why don't we keep going? Here is just a graphic illustration of the mechanism that we're talking about on the waterfront. This would be the proposal that a developer, again, a generic proposal that could be done under the zoning if there were no affordable housing included. Next. And what we do is to say that the density of the development can increase in exchange for the creation of some level of affordable housing. And the range comes, we say, between 15 and 25% of all the units that are created would be affordable. The range comes because we are allowing a range of different income levels. And if I could have the next. I won't dwell on the details here, but quite simply what we said is every developer must provide a base level of affordable housing for the very lowest income residents in the city. And the incomes that we're talking about for a family of four, roughly $30,000 to $40,000 a year. So the lowest income levels of families in the city, but also has options to create some level of affordable housing for moderate income families as well. Next. Why don't we go on? And at the same time, I mentioned earlier we have a significant part of the development happening on the waterfront. There is also rezoning going on in an upland area, which it has an existing residential context. And so here, in an interest of looking at and understanding the local context, both in terms of density and development types, we've included this sort of inclusionary zoning option, but in a very different form, with a lower level of sort of variation in the density that would be allowed based on the inclusion of affordable housing. Next. Let's keep going. And finally, I just mentioned that the use of those public sites that the city has to guarantee that there's affordable housing produced where the city controls land. Next. For those not familiar with the land use review process in New York City, just to give you a sense of where this project is, there is a very long and extensive process that every rezoning like this goes through in New York, from the City Planning Commission to the local community board who reviews it and comments on it and votes, the borough president, a City Planning Commission review, and finally to approval within the City Council here in New York City. And right now we expect that process to be completed by May of 2005. Then finally, if I could have the next slide, please. Just three items that I would highlight in terms of, I think, the broader context and the discussion that's been had at the conference here. First of all, what we've experienced in these rezonings is a significant clash of sort of citywide needs for increased density. I talked about initially the dramatic need that we have for the creation of new housing at all income levels. And yet, the very legitimate concerns at the local community level about what would this density do to change, gentrify, et cetera, the local community. And one of the things I think that this zoning policy sort of introduces into that dynamic is the local community really has no benefit from that extra density. There might be an abstract notion that by adding 100,000 or more units to the city's housing stock, in fact, we have a positive impact on the affordability of the housing citywide, but there's no real direct felt impact of local residents of that. By connecting very directly the increase in density to the production of affordable housing and the preservation of affordable housing in the neighborhood, we make that connection much more real and much more direct for local community residents. At the same time, we have a significant sort of debate, if you will, within the community. How do we guarantee that this housing gets created versus the long-term and sort of speculative nature of the way housing gets developed in the city and the economics of that? If we were to essentially force developers to create certain types of housing or economics, we risk not getting that development at all. And so there's that tension, that balance that we have with the debate with the local community and housing advocates and others. How much of this can we advocate and incentivize versus how much can we actually mandate that developers do? And then finally, and I think most importantly, that we see this zoning policy and the need to create affordable housing as a bedrock way of fighting the potential increased segregation that the city may face as a result of rising real estate values. There's been a lot of focus in social policy in the United States on how do we break up concentrations of poverty in the lowest income neighborhoods. And that's really sort of the pull, I would say, of an integration policy. Much less effort has been focused on in areas like the Greenpoint-Williamsburg waterfront and others where there's rezoning. How do we really take on the opposite? How do we ensure that any community that we're creating is, from its very beginning, an integrated community, both in terms of income and race? And we see this zoning policy as one, but a very important tool in terms of ensuring that those new hidden neighborhoods that are created don't sort of perpetuate the pattern of extreme income segregation and racial segregation that we've seen in American cities. Thank you.